presidential race is like a mountain hike, and Donald Trump keeps adding rocks to his backpack, and it makes it very difficult for him to get to the top.
I'm constantly just taken aback at the kinds of things that he advocates for. You know, Maya Angelou said, when someone shows you who they are, believe them. And once again, he has showed us who he is.
Donald's comments today are just the latest demonstration that he hasn't thought seriously about the problems facing this country, that he's willing to say anything to try to get elected.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is 5:09 on this Thursday, March 31st, the last day of the month 2016. It looks like we might go out like a lion. Severe weather possible south and southwest of Chicago this morning and later today. And then April Fool's Day tomorrow. Let's hope the markets don't give us a big joke today. They are mostly lower in Europe as we check the WGN Market Desk overnight global intel. And the reason behind this is we're waiting on the jobless report later on this morning. 7:30 Chicago time is when we expect that to be released. Europe, all of the indices are lower this morning. The FTSE off this morning, the DAX off as well, some by almost 1%. Dow futures here in the United States also pointing toward a lower open later on this morning. Again, that jobless report comes out at 7:30 Chicago time, and we expect the Labor Department to report on the number of people who applied for unemployment benefits last week. These generally have been good reports over the last couple of months. Also, Freddie Mac will release average mortgage rates this week. Yesterday, the Dow Jones Industrials rose about 84 points. The S&P gained about 9 points. The NASDAQ added about 23 points. Here in Illinois, tomorrow will mark 9 months without a state budget. No April Fool's joke. The state treasurer of Illinois, Michael Furyk, says the game in Springfield has been going on too long.
We could point to any number of times in our state's history where we face fiscal problems. But I think most everyone here would agree that this year is different. Our politics have become too divisive. Parts of our state government have ground to a halt. People are hurting.
Furyk mentioned the state's longstanding budget impasse. He vowed to continue to make changes to help finances grow. The state's plan, his example, would require Illinois businesses with at least 25 employees to either offer a private market retirement savings plan or automatically enroll employees into the state-run Secure Choice program. Furyk was at the City Club of Chicago earlier this week. You can hear his full comments and see them online at WGNradio.com. Oak Brook-based McDonald's Corporation says it plans to open 1,500 new restaurants in China, South Korea, and Hong Kong as it looks to faster-growing markets to help drive a global turnaround. McDonald's is saying today it'll give local managers more design-making power to respond to Asian customers. The company's overhauling its business worldwide under CEO Steve Easterbrook after acknowledging it failed to keep up with changing tastes. The total number of diners visiting its restaurants fell last year. Easterbrook, in a statement, that Asia represents an opportunity to, quote, blend our global quality standards with local insights. By the way, just another note here on McDonald's, if you don't follow them closely, they received a trademark for a new slogan. So maybe they're getting tired of you're loving it. They've got this trademark for the new slogan that they may roll out in the next coming days. So that brings us to today's guest. You may have recalled last week there was a huge announcement by SeaWorld that it was going to stop its whale shows and stop breeding whales in captivity. This was a major development. It follows a tumultuous couple of years for the SeaWorld organization. One in Indiana near Chicago, southwest of Chicago, woman who was a trainer there, Dawn Brinshaw, was killed in one of the shows by a whale. There's been a lot of criticism from animal rights group. Let's bring in Dale Buss, who has written about this for Forbes. As a matter of fact, Dale has had the first exclusive one-on-one interview with the CEO of SeaWorld since this announcement. Dale, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell again.
Good morning. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, this is a really big interview. What insight did you get from the CEO?
Well, I know the CEO, Joel Manby, very well. Actually, he's an old friend of mine, and I helped him write a book a few years ago when he was the CEO of Hirschend Family Entertainment, which is based in Atlanta. It's kind of a mid-tier, operator of a mid-tier amusement parks, places like Dollywood, Silver Dollar City in Branson, Missouri, places a lot of Chicagoans have been, certainly. And he took on the challenge of becoming CEO of SeaWorld about a year ago, figuring that they were a great traditional entertainment brand in this country that needed some help because they had been kind of drowning, forgive the pun, after this documentary called Blackfish was released in 2013, as you mentioned, kind of documenting the dark side of Shamu, let's say. And so after about a year, he finally made the decision, look, we have to go in another direction. The tide of society, public opinion, especially among millennials, is just running too hard against the notion, even of animals in captivity, especially, given the dramatic things that had happened at SeaWorld. And there was precedent for the kind of decision that he made. For instance, Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus decided recently that they were going to take all their elephants out of their shows eventually and put them in a big 200-acre conservation park. So this is the way that the culture is going. This is what people think now. And Manby kind of made the courageous decision, even though he didn't think initially he would have to do that, but he made the decision, look, we've just got to go in another direction at SeaWorld.
Our conversation this morning with Dale Buss of Forbes magazine. He's interviewed the CEO of SeaWorld after the company's decision to end its whale shows. We're going to get into more of this and talk more about where the organization goes from here, what we might see from SeaWorld in the future as the opening bell continues.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now, the Dow Jones Industrial Average picked up another 84 points yesterday, closing at 17,717. The S&P 500 gained 9 points. The NASDAQ added 23. Traders were encouraged by Fed Chairwoman Janet Yellen's comments affirming plans to move slowly in raising interest rates. California state lawmakers are poised to enact the nation's highest statewide minimum wage, with gradual increases to $15 an hour by 2022. Opponents say it'll further harm California's already poor business climate. Chipotle Mexican Grill is looking past the food scares that sent its sales plunging. It's already sparked other fast casual startups. Now the Denver-based chain apparently plans for a Chipotle-style hamburger concept. Two Tennessee-based cancer charities labeled shams by the Federal Trade Commission have settled a massive fraud case, agreeing to pay $75.8 million and dissolve their businesses. Donations meant for cancer patients went to six-figure salaries and luxury vacations for the bosses at the charity. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It's 520. Welcome back to The Opening Bell.
Some say, free the whales. For them, nothing else is acceptable. But nothing could be worse for the whales.
That's a promotional video by SeaWorld. We're having a conversation this morning with Dale Buss, who's gotten the first interview with the CEO of SeaWorld after their decision to end their whale shows and end their breeding programs for orcas. Dale, I'm interested to know what the brand is going to look like going forward here and whether the public is going to buy into the new vision.
That is the $64 million question for SeaWorld and for Joel Manby, the CEO. It's one thing to feel like the public is kind of overwhelmingly opposed to what you're doing, and so therefore ending these shows with orcas over time, it's one thing to kind of give in to that sensibility that, okay, maybe large animals in captivity is not the greatest idea and not something that you should build a business on. But it's another thing to replace what has been the brand for SeaWorld and its three parks, for decades. And that's the challenge for Joel Manby and for SeaWorld. What they're trying to pivot to is becoming a brand that's associated with marine conservation, marine rescue. At the parks, the way you're going to see this is instead of a bunch of whales leaping around in a few years, you're going to maybe have a conversation with the trainer while the whale kind of swims around in the background. You're also going to see the parks emphasize this conservation and nature theme more. For example, they're finishing a huge new roller coaster at the park in Orlando. It's going to be named after the Mako shark. So not only is it going to be a thrilling ride, but they're also going to have association with a cause like let's teach you about why sharks are killed to remove their fins for soup, for shark fin soup in Asia. Let's try to help stop this. let's buy a T-shirt that says, you know, ban shark fin soup at the end of the ride, that kind of thing. That's what they're hoping will work over the longer term. And you got to remember that the orcas are still going to be around in the shows for a few more years, and then they live for decades. So the orcas will still be definitely a part of the brand and the experience there.
It's interesting, in your story you write that the visitors to one of the tests that they've been doing, I think out in San Diego, seem to respond positively to this new animal matters theme. They've been doing a little bit of surveying. People seem to like it. Do they like it enough to pay the entry fee and keep coming back?
Well, that's what they don't know for sure, but that's certainly one of the things that Joel Manby talked about with employees when he went around to the three SeaWorlds, Orlando, San Diego, San Antonio, immediately after his announcement last week, to try and reassure them, you know, to give them a shoulder to cry on, to encourage them that there is a future for the brand and the parks and for their jobs. And that's one of the things he pointed to is, look, we've already tested this in San Diego. We've already had kind of a refined orca experience without the leaping and the trick kind of stuff in the water, and it seemed that consumers responded positively. But, you know, over the long term, I just don't know. It's a huge, huge issue. It's kind of like, you know, asking McDonald's not to sell a Big Mac and then expecting it not to make a big difference. So this is going to be a long slog for SeaWorld. I think they feel, you know, they've made a tough decision. They've gotten over that big hump. But the future, you know, really remains uncertain.
And the money aspect of this, too, is one that is probably concerning SeaWorld. The Blackstone Group private equity company, which really was the funder of SeaWorld for a long time, reduced its stake from 63% to 25% back in 2014. Are they going to have the money going forward? It's obviously a good mission that they're on with animals, but if they don't have money to back them, they're going to have a problem.
Well, Joel Manby, the CEO, told me that one of the aspects of this decision, as difficult as it was to make sure that everybody, all the major constituents of the company, were on board. And, of course, that certainly included the Blackstone Group, who signed off on his decision and had given him their support, as well as everybody else on the board. So I think the money isn't going anywhere for the moment. Blackstone is still invested, as well as other investors. And, in fact, in the immediate aftermath of his announcement, the stock price went up about 20%. So there is some definitely some investor confidence, or at least agreement, that that decision needed to be made. But again, that doesn't reassure us of anything for the long term.
And then the other part of this, too, is I thought it was interesting that the animal rights groups stood with them in making this announcement. They have not been partners for a long time or ever.
Yeah, exactly. And a very good and clever decision by SeaWorld to get the Humane Society of the United States to actually be a partner in this decision and say, you know, we think they're going in the right direction. And even the woman who directed Blackfish said, look, I think they've made a big step in the right direction. So those were, you know, crucial kinds of endorsements for Joel Manby to get if he was going to make this kind of decision, which would, you know, so dislocate their business model over the long term.
And so they do these groups have a stake in helping SeaWorld survive financially?
Financially, I think all they could do is leave it alone. But the Humane Society, as I said, is a partner, and they are going to be doing some things with SeaWorld at the parks. So, sure, I could see them having a financial stake in SeaWorld in the future, you know, through a partnership, maybe activated through licensing or some other retail arrangement in the parks. And don't forget that this is where Joel Manby has proven his expertise working for Hirschend, is monetizing what goes on in those parks and getting the maximum out of both employees and the brand. So that's the confidence that SeaWorld can have going forward.
Dale Buss is a contributor at Forbes magazine. You can read his latest on the interview with the SeaWorld CEO at Forbes.com and follow him on Twitter at Dale D. Buss. Dale, always good to have you on the Opening Bell.
Thanks again, Steve.
This morning, by the way, SeaWorld is trading higher, up about 59 cents a share at $21.45 on the New York Stock Exchange pre-market, SEASC, SeaWorld Entertainment Incorporated. It's 5:27 on the Opening Bell. Let's head to the newsroom. Vic Vaughn is standing by with a look at what's coming up. Vic?
Well, Steve, we're getting our first look at homicide numbers in Chicago during the first quarter of the year. They are way up, so we're going to go over those numbers as well as shootings right after this.
All right, it's 5:28 on the Opening Bell.
from ABC News. Tech trends. More bad news for BlackBerry.
Talk about kicking someone when they're down.
On the heels of the announcement from WhatsApp that it will no longer be available on BlackBerry devices, comes word that its parent company, Facebook, is also bailing out.
Basically, by the end of the year, these apps won't work on BlackBerry anymore, and Facebook will suspend development. So it goes way beyond Facebook just not choosing to update the apps anymore. They're just not going to work on BlackBerry.
Dana Wollman is with the tech blog Engadget.
If you were asked to name the biggest apps for any platform, I'm sure Facebook would top anybody's list. So that's a really big loss.
Part of the problem, Wollman says, is BlackBerry's inability to break through and grab a larger slice of the smartphone market.
BlackBerry's position has already been tenuous. It's already struggling. It accounts at this point for very, very small sliver of smartphone sales.
Androids, iPhones, and Windows phones account for 99.5% of all smartphone sales. With Tech Trends, I'm Karen Chase, ABC News.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
It's 5:38. Welcome back to the program. Chicago is home to more than 30 Fortune 500 companies, including 9 within the city limits proper, and we're known as the city that works. So why aren't we ranked up there with Silicon Valley and Austin and some other places, New York City, as a tech and startup hub? We do have quite a reputation locally. Everybody who lives here knows that. Let's talk about this morning with Christopher Wink of Technical.ly, who is with us on the Opening Bell. He's been looking into this. Christopher, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, are we being dissed? Is Chicago being dissed when it comes to our reputation in this regard?
I think you can say some of that. So, yeah, us technically, we're a tech news site on the East Coast. We used to tour with Comcast, NBC Universal, and came to Chicago alongside Detroit and Denver and Miami. A lot of these places just did some reporting. And it's easy to say so many of these cities have enormous technology sectors, both in the IT space and innovation happening elsewhere. But we only let a couple cities sneak into our shorthand for being national tech hubs, and that is the Valleys and maybe the Seattles, maybe the Bostons, and more should be there. And I think you could say, yeah, Chicago's getting dissed. I think you could say that, and there's probably some work that can be done to change that.
What is it? What are the requirements for making it into that little group of cities? I mean, what would you consider to be, you know, the ranking, allow that ranking?
Yeah, it's worth saying that a lot of this is the same thing as, you know, what's a great local arts community. There's a lot of soft metrics. It's the common people, industry leaders know about a few successes that came out of a specific city. And is the marketing strategy on point? There's some real data. People use venture capital deal flow to convey real hubs. But venture capital isn't the end-all, be-all. It's just one metric people use. And Chicago, if you talk to someone like Fred Hoke at the Illinois Technology Association, who we have, he feels that Chicago, for a city of its size and its scale, it did in 2015 $1 billion in venture capital deals with Chicago companies. He thinks that should be like something like $5 billion, which would put Chicago in one of the top four or five venture capital deal flow communities, instead of being something like 10 or so, a 10th in the country. What? So even though that's one specific metric you could see change, but there's a lot that goes into it, and so much of it's soft, right? Like Groupon was a really big opportunity for Chicago's technology community and did attract a lot of workers. It did get a lot of attention, but that missed opportunity, some sagging stock price, makes some in the Chicago technology entrepreneurship community feel like that was one missed opportunity to really build Chicago's narrative, and maybe that opportunity was lost, so we need to do it again.
Well, I know that you guys have technically and teamed up with Comcast, and you've kind of been going around the country on a tour, and during your stop in Chicago, you asked some of the leaders here what it's going to take to put us on that map. What was the game plan?
Yeah, some of them were fun to hear. Again, yeah, we did Comcast, and technically we went to a bunch of different cities, and some of the stories were somewhat similar. Everyone feels, hey, we don't have enough venture capital. That's a really common concern from every early stage technology community. But some of them were very distinctly Chicago. We heard a few times people feel like there is this real coastal bias, that because of the Silicon Valley trickle down the West Coast, and because of New York as a finance capital, and just that dense corridor on the East Coast that goes beyond it, a lot of the stories around innovation, quote unquote, are really staying stuck in those media centers and places like Chicago and other Midwest cities that have real strong technology communities. Like any national story they want told gets tougher. It stays stuck on the coasts. So there was a sense that we just got to do a better job of pushing out and saying, we do have big stories. Waylon Wong, who's a former Tribune reporter who was now runs the podcast Distance about small businesses, said something that I love, that she thought that the deal of Grubhub merging with New York-based Seamless, she thought that Grubhub never got its deal, never got its share of attention on the national stage. So she thinks that there's a big coastal bias. But there's also, like, you got to play to our strengths. Got to get the corporate community that is here, that we do know, that you sit at the top, is really strong, needs more attention. John Pletz, he's a great tech reporter for Cranes in Chicago. He talks a lot about who's that big name in lights that's going to connect Chicago's startup community with its corporate community. And people are working on this. Places like TechNexus and 1871, great incubators, are doing a great job of putting people in the same room. But we see this in a lot of cities. Communities say, we need to get our existing corporate community to want to test and innovate with small startups in our region. One, so those big companies can get access to new ideas, but also because maybe we'll help develop that next big company that coming out of it. The capital comes up and the successes come out. Because, yeah, Chicago has a great, a ton of these large exits that are really prominent. You know, that's IBM buying someone like CleverSafe for $1.3 billion last year, or the TrustWave deal bought by a Singapore company for $810 million. Big deals have happened here. Maybe we want more that gets a little attention. And one last thing I'll throw at you that came out of all of our tour stops and is probably the best news for Chicago is we're watching, as we visit different cities as a news organization reporting on this, great entrepreneurship hubs are now growing exactly where great cities are developing, where people want to live, because we have more choice than ever where to live. And I think no one questions that that's something that Chicago is doing really well, creating a place where more people can live. We just need more people to join in the success of this conversation.
And hopefully we'll have more coverage by Technically and other magazines and articles, and some of these West Coast and East Coast reporters maybe could come visit Chicago more often and see what we have here.
I think that sounds great.
Christopher Wink of Technically. You can find him on Twitter, by the way, at Christopher Wink. Good of you to be with us again on the Opening Bell.
Thanks so much for having us.
It is 5:45. By the way, a couple of notes here along this area. Later on today, 11:30, 1871 CEO Howard Tolman is going to be speaking at the City Club of Chicago, which is at Maggiano's. They generally stream live online, so you'll be able to see 1871 CEO Howard Tolman again. That's at 11:30 a.m. Central Time. And yesterday, if it passed your attention, the state of Illinois, Governor Rauner, and the state's CIO announced that they were moving forward with the formation of the new Illinois Department of Innovation and Technology. An announcement yesterday with the new digital transformation. This agency is going to lead digital transformation and increase interagency efficiency to improve delivery of services to residents and businesses. So just another spoke in the wheel there to help move Illinois forward with innovation and technology.
You're listening to the Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It's 5:50 on the markets this morning. The market desk showing futures lower, an opening that will likely be lower when the opening bell rings later this morning. Dow futures off 23, S&P futures off about 4, NASDAQ futures off about 8. The latest on the rest of commodities, here's Orion Samuelson.
Steve, good morning. The last trading day of the month and a day of two very important reports from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Later today during the trading session, they will report farmers' planting intentions for this year, and we'll also get the quarterly grain stocks report. But let's look at livestock first. It hasn't been easy being a cattle feeder the past few months because we see some real volatility, and we saw it again yesterday as live cattle futures fell sharply. Technical selling on the eve of the last trading day for the quarter, April live cattle down $2.50 and ending the day at $132.35. And feeder cattle also moved sharply lower during the day. We saw down limit moves in feeder cattle at one point. Have a good day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. The U.S. Geological Survey earlier this week reported that there are more earthquakes happening in Oklahoma, and they pointed to fracking as possible as the likely cause of it. There was also a warning, too, that these earthquakes are going to only get worse and potentially create a disaster. We were talking yesterday with ABC News correspondent Jim Ryan about this. He's been covering. Jim, this is obviously a warning from the USGS about possibly something serious coming for the middle of the country.
Yeah, and it comes in a map that's been drawn up, Steve. It points out the risk of earthquakes for various parts of the country. And for the first time, by the way, Oklahoma is as great a risk for earthquake as California is. So you move to just north of Oklahoma City, it'll be sort of like moving to Southern California in terms of your earthquake risk. But for the first time, the USGS, the U.S. Geological Survey, lays out not only naturally occurring earthquakes, but ones that it suspects are induced. In other words, that human activity have had a hand in. It's sort of like the dispute and the debate over climate change. This has to do with human interaction with the earth and the potential that we are causing some of the earthquakes that we're feeling in parts of the country, Steve.
And there are places in Oklahoma, if you look at a map of Oklahoma and the daily earthquakes that occur, and they are daily, numerous yeah. earthquakes that are as big as 4 and 5 on the magnitude scale. This is something that Oklahomans have long suggested. Why did it take so long for the USGS to get on board with this? And are they warning of potential disaster?
Well, they're warning of stronger earthquakes or the potential for stronger earthquakes here in Dallas-Fort Worth and as far north as the Oklahoma-Kansas border. That's the expectation based on what they see out there in terms not only of statistics, but of the science and what's going on out there. They place the blame at least partially on the practice, and it's not fracking in and of itself. It's the wastewater reinjection that's done in very near fault lines. It seems to aggravate those fault lines, to reawaken them, even dormant lines that nobody has seen earthquakes for generations or even centuries, suddenly being, in effect, reawakened, Steve.
And the USGS is pretty serious about this stuff when it comes to earthquakes. They actually pointed to Illinois in one of these recent conversations that they do, a webinar, as they're called. And they warned Illinois because, you know, we have the New Madrid Fault that runs through southern Illinois and Kentucky and Missouri, which produced the largest earthquake ever recorded on Earth, I believe. Is there a danger that fracking in these areas can cause those other faults to have problems as well?
Well, I don't think any are as extensive as the New Madrid Fault. I think, actually, didn't the Mississippi River reverse course
it
when
did.
That earthquake took place?
Yeah.
Just amazing to consider the power of that. Now, none of them so far, they're sort of a nuisance at this point and kind of a novelty, I suppose, for people in Oklahoma and Kansas. They feel it. They're getting used to it, I suppose. And there's been some minor damage, but nothing really serious. But that is the concern, I think. And that's why this map has been drawn up, Steve, to give not only insurance companies a look at where their potential liability lies out there, but also emergency planners. So that as they do their tabletop exercises and planning for future disasters or the potential, they can factor that in and say, what do we need to know about building collapse? How do we protect our citizens from that or be prepared for that possibility?
I was covering one group before Illinois approved fracking in southern Illinois that was fighting this idea. And one of the members of this group said, this is like lighting a match near gasoline. If the New Madrid Fault goes off, you're going to have disaster in multiple states.
Right, that's entirely possible. But, you know, Yeah, it's just a matter of extent. And even if they stopped all fracking and wastewater reinjection at this point, there would still be some residual earthquakes, according to scientists who've looked at this. So as gas prices, as fuel prices start to rise again, oil prices start to come back up, and activity out there in the oil field starts to increase to perhaps levels where it was just a few years ago, it's likely that we'll continue to see these earthquakes in the future, Steve.
And that's one.
And by the way, in yesterday, just the last 24 hours, there have been 6 earthquakes in Oklahoma alone.
And so the question then is, has the USGS or will the USGS offer any direction? Are they suggesting the stoppage of fracking or any sort of response?
No, not really. And in fact, they've just sort of dipped their toe into this very controversial issue. You look at state regulatory boards in Texas, Oklahoma, and Illinois. You know, they don't want to stifle the growth out there in the energy industry. There's a lot of money in that and a lot of revenue and a lot of jobs tied up in it. And so they don't want to dive into it. Neither does the USGS so much for political reasons. But they do call it induced earthquakes. And without going so far as to say it's a result of fracking, but that there is some suspicion that it's human activity that's involved.
ABC News correspondent Jim Ryan with us from Dallas. So the USGS, by the way, says 7 million people live in areas where the risk has dramatically jumped for earthquakes caused by the disposal of wastewater, a byproduct of fracking. Natural earthquake risk not only increased around Oklahoma, but the USGS specifically noted that it increased around the New Madrid Fault in Missouri, Tennessee, Kentucky, Arkansas, and right here in Illinois. That's the opening bell for today. Please join us again tomorrow morning for another edition, bright and early at 5 a.m. The Steve Cochran Show is up next. Our producer is Mary Sandberg. Production help from Mike Jacobson, and our engineer is Ben Cortez. I'm Steve Grzanich. Have a great day.